supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Pennsylvania U.S. Senator Pat Toomey urges President-elect Donald Trump to take immediate action against Philadelphia for failing to cooperate with federal immigration authorities. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, Toomey declared on the Senate floor that the city's sanctuary city status endangers public safety.
Toomey rattled off the names of three Philadelphia criminals in recent years who entered the country illegally. He said the city refused to alert Immigration and Customs Enforcement about them when they were released.
How can this possibly happen that a city would knowingly, willfully, and repeatedly choose to release dangerous criminals, including child molesters, who don't even have a right to be in the United States in the first place because they came here illegally?
Toomey's hoping that the Republican majority passes his bill, which will deprive sanctuary cities of federal community development block grants. Philadelphia used nearly $39 million of that grant funding this year. A spokesman for Mayor Jim Kenney says it's bad policing to turn local cops into immigration agents, and that many city police investigations rely on the cooperation of undocumented immigrants. Toomey isn't buying it.
This isn't the police's fault. Police would much rather be cooperating with federal immigration officials. They're not allowed to because local politicians in cities across America have decided that they won't allow it to take place.
The immigration issue was a hot topic in Toomey's race against challenger Katie McGinty. He accused her of waffling on sanctuary cities. Toomey went on to defeat McGinty by nearly 2 percentage points. On the Senate floor, Toomey called on Trump to cut off funds to cities harboring undocumented immigrants as soon as he takes office in January. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
The Fair Housing Act in New Jersey requires every city or town to zone for its, quote, fair share of affordable housing. But from 1999 to 2015, cities and towns didn't know what their fair shares were. And a dispute over whether they still have to build affordable housing from that period went before the state Supreme Court today. More from WHYY's Joe Hernandez.
The law left it up to a state agency to decide what each city or town's, quote, fair share of affordable housing would be. But from 1999 to 2015, 16 years, that agency was just not working. It didn't give cities or towns any guidance on how much affordable housing to build. So now the dispute is, going forward, whether cities and towns are responsible for the affordable housing they didn't zone for during those 16 years. Jeff Serenian represents a group of nearly 50 municipalities. It got heated in oral arguments before the state Supreme Court when Serenian said affordable housing obligations from those 16 years should be forgotten.
But are you saying that there is no obligation?
What the legislature said.
No, please answer my question. Are you saying that there's no obligation on the part of those municipalities to do anything over those 17 years?
I'm saying that unless the people for 16 years don't count.
Well, I
disappear from the map. Is that correct? Is that your interpretation?
I'm saying that. Yes.
I don't want you to say. I want you to answer my question.
Serenian says the law only requires that cities and towns build affordable housing based on current and future needs, not what was needed in the past. But Kevin Walsh, who runs the nonprofit Fair Share Housing Center, says there's broad support for more affordable housing in the state.
We do this well in New Jersey. We've provided 80,000 homes in the state that are affordable. We've done so because we've figured out how to do it for decades now. The private sector's on board, nonprofits are on board, municipalities know how to do it, they just lack the will to do it.
A lower court previously ruled that cities and towns did not have to build units for that 16-year gap period. Attorneys are expecting a ruling in the coming months. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Next summer, Philadelphia's Mural Arts Program will create a public art installation about criminal justice reform. And until then, it's hosting discussions and workshops focused on solving problems in the American prison system. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that the first workshop took place today inside Greaterford Maximum Security Prison in Montgomery County.
To inform its upcoming public art installation on criminal justice reform, the Mural Arts Program wanted to hear directly from prisoners. Director Jane Golden is preparing them and the public for the day prisoners are released back into society.
I see how seductive the streets are. It's pretty overwhelming when opportunities are limited and your safety net, it's about where you were instead of where you're going. And that's terrifying.
Some of y'all may not know this, but there's a whole lot of people on the outside that are working really hard on your behalf.
Inside Grateford Prison, actor Malik Yoba addressed an audience of prisoners. He was joined by former prisoners who have since become artists and activists. They shared stories about overcoming feelings of fear, anger, and failure while inside.
Say the truth is that they want us to fail.
This is the first event, streamed live on Facebook, of a planned series to raise awareness of adverse policies and social stigmas related to incarceration. The project is called Voices. During his impromptu performance, Yoba invited an inmate on stage with him to add his voice.
He's talking about truth and about his peace.
Other planned workshops will take place in more public places, which will inform the culmination of this Voices project, a public art installation next summer created by artist Hank Willis Thomas and former prisoner Jesse Crimes. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Once thought of as an ideal toy, model railroads are becoming more of a museum piece than a plaything. And while it may seem like the entire world is clamoring for the fastest smartphones, tablets, 4K TVs, and first-person video games, some long for the hobbies of their youth or their grandparents' youth. Rob Savatsky reports on two local venues where model railroads are still king.
Lawrence T. Geringer got the big idea for his tiny world in 1903 when he was only 9 years old. Located along Interstate 78 in Charlottesville, Pennsylvania, Roadside America is a more than 6,000-square-foot handcrafted display featuring model railroads, moving waterways, working lights, and miniature buildings. A lifelong passion project of Geringer's, the mini-museum in Berks County was finally completed in 1963, when Geringer died.
Everything is hand-built by scratch. Everything is scrapwood, and I mean everything he did. All the lighting, all the painting, trees, houses, landscaping, every single thing.
Brian Hilbert is the manager of Roadside America. He's married to Geringer's great-granddaughter. He says in 1953 the display attracted more than 100,000 visitors. This year he expects about 38,000 and says those numbers are growing again.
People that have come here now, they've been here when their grandparents brought them here, or like their parents have brought them here, and then they're bringing their kids here.
Tradition is one of the reasons 36-year-old Jeff Carroll traveled with his family more than 3 hours from Chesapeake, Maryland, to take in the miniature landscape. He says his wife visited Roadside America with her parents when she was young, and they want their children to share in that experience.
I think it's very important that we keep exhibits like this going across the country as new theme parks and different, you know, attractions come up upon us. These kind of things tend to phase out, but this is one that has remained. So I think it's really important that we keep things like this open by coming to visit them and passing on these, you know, this history to our children.
About 80 miles down the track and over the Delaware River in Flemington, New Jersey, Bruce Zach and Nino's hobby has expanded into what the Guinness Book of World Records calls the world's largest model train exhibit. It's called Northlands. It has 40,000 square feet of track with more than 80 trains running simultaneously. It's such a big deal for train enthusiasts that the entryway features famous autographs, including Neil Young, Rod Stewart, and Pee-wee Herman, to name a few. Zach and Nino is solely responsible for the design and maintenance of the display. He says it's popular in a day of virtual reality because it's tangible and real.
Everything is so digital with games and internet, social internet and so forth. This is something you can sink your teeth in, entertainment-wise.
82-year-old Kit DeLupi visited from Quakertown, Pennsylvania. She says she hopes places like Northlands last for a very long time because they give people a connection to the past.
It's educational. It's things that are going out that our little ones don't see.
Zach and Nino has plans to expand Northlands in the near future. Roadside America is seeking to raise $80,000 through a GoFundMe campaign to repair a leaky roof. Hilbert says the leaks have yet to affect the display. but it could if they can't make the fix. For WHYY, I'm Rob Zavatsky.
Still ahead this evening, we'll meet a Philadelphia artisan who's at the forefront of a musical craft.
Today, there is a very vibrant community of people who are making violin bows in this country and other countries throughout the world by hand.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Linda Jarrah went to the doctor for a sinus infection. She took an antibiotic but didn't feel better. A few weeks passed, and after many more doctor's visits and tests, the 43-year-old found out that her heart was failing. Last year, she told her story on WHYY's health and science show, The Pulse.
They knew that they had to go to the next step, that I was not getting any better. So March 3rd, my mother's birthday, I had the LVAD put in. And what this device does is I have a pump that's right up, I guess, right above my rib cage, and it has two, look like hoses that go in, and it's used to bypass the aorta. And it's a continuous flow that will keep my heart pumping. So I can't have a heart attack if that was to happen. I don't have a pulse. I can tell you where you can microphone it. That's what I sound like on the inside. So there's a guy at work who likes to make a joke about how anyone could come in his room as long as they have a pulse. And I was like, well, I'll just wait outside. So I could not come home because I live by myself. So I spent 3 months at my sister's house, sleeping in my niece's room. And she's 8 now and my nephew's 7. And there's always a story I tell about my nephew and my recovery. And I started with like walking 2 rooms down from mine in the hospital. And when I got to my sister's, I would do the hallway. That's about as much as I could do when physical therapy started. And I remember it was right before Easter and I had gone outside and I put some stuff in the mailbox and I walked up and down my sister's driveway and I did it for 7 minutes. And I was so excited. And I came in and Brendan, my nephew, was the first person I saw. And I was like, Brendan, guess what? And he's like, what? He's excited for me. And I said, I just walked for 7 minutes straight. And his smile like turned into like disgust. And he was like, are you kidding me? That is like kindergarten easy. I was just laughing because I wasn't laughing then. I kind of shuffled back to the bedroom and like put my head down. I was like, oh, I guess it was kindergarten easy. And I tell that story because I now do the elliptical. And the longest time I've spent on the elliptical is 7 miles. I'm really trying to get active. I went back to work full time. I teach 11th grade at Valley Forge Military Academy. I went to one of the support groups at Temple. And there were 4 of us there. It was myself, 76-year-old man, 78-year-old woman, and an 84-year-old woman. Like when we were talking, they were talking things like, oh, you should get a shower chair. And I'm like, a shower chair? So you don't fall in the shower? I'm like, what? I'm like, I'm not going to fall in the shower. There are people on VADs who are so unhappy that they have this device. And obviously I can't go in water. I can get electrocuted. And They just go on and they'll just complain about how they can't go swimming and they can't. But I'm like, but you're alive. And it was looking pretty bad for me. You know, I was glad to be alive. And there have been people who are considering VADs or people who just ask me, they're like, what made you decide to get this? And I was like, I didn't have a choice. I just remember, you know, at that time, my niece was 7. She's the oldest. And I just said, I want to dance at her wedding. And I don't, you know, I want to be around for that. It's scary. There's so much information coming at you, things I never even thought about before. There are 200,000 people that need hearts a year and about 2,000 become available. Hearts are good on average for about 10 years. Lungs are good for about 5 to 7 years. And I said, well, what does that mean? What do you mean, like 10 years? They're like, well, in 10 years, then you just get listed again for, and I'm like, I have to go through this again? And I was like, wait a minute. I don't even know if I want to do this now. And I was like, what are my chances? I did say, what are my odds if I just leave the hospital? I don't think my odds were very good. I don't think I had odds, to be honest with you. When I was first recovering and getting more out of the house at my sister's, people would say, oh, I could never do what you did. And I could never go through this. And I would say, you would. Because when you're faced with these decisions, like you have to do it.
Linda Jara underwent a heart transplant after all. She'll be speaking at an upcoming story slam called Stories from the Heart, hosted by WHYY's The Pulse and the American College of Physicians Annals of Internal Medicine on December 7th at WHYY. More information at whyy.org/events. When one thinks of violin makers, images of Baroque-era craftsmen come to mind. This month, an instrument shop in Philadelphia is hosting a show drawing on the work of 40 contemporary makers of violins, violas, cellos, and bows. Elizabeth Vanderveer Schock is the proprietor and chief bow maker of Mount Airy Violins and Bows. She talked with Newsworks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas about the state of the craft today.
Elizabeth Vanderveer Schock, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The craft of violin making is fairly well known. I think almost anybody, man on the street, could reel off the name Stradivarius. But bow making, people don't often think of that as its own craft.
That is true. And it's been separate from the time of Stradivarius. And it actually grew to be what it is today in France and not Italy. And today there is a very vibrant community of people who are making violin bows in this country and other countries throughout the world by hand. And as there is an incredible resurgence of people making violins and violas, cellos.
So talk a little bit about the craft of bow making. How do you go about conceptualizing a custom bow and actually executing it?
You have to start with really wonderful, beautiful models, pieces that play really well and that inspire you. And I spend a lot of time looking at them and measuring them and figuring out what I can figure out about them. And then I pick out the piece of wood based on what the player is hoping to accomplish by getting a new bow and start from there. Often I'll do my own model. Sometimes I'll do a model that inspires the player too.
So it sounds like there's sort of a lineage if you're being inspired by really fine bows that already exist.
The very fun part about this is that you get to use history as your jumping off point, and you can delve into that deeply. And you can use modern techniques today to help you reach your goals.
What kind of modern techniques would those be?
I created a computer program which tracks the graduations of a bow as it's getting made. And the graduations are the thicknesses along the length of a bow. And I can measure that for old bows that play fantastically and account for the density of the wood and approach that in my own work.
Do you have favorite woods that you gravitate towards?
Well, there is really only one wood you can use. It's called Pernambuco. It is now embargoed. I think that's the right word. You can't really import raw wood into this country anymore. I was lucky enough to purchase my wood when it was legal and register it with the U.S. Wildlife. So everything I use is legal.
So how long has Pernambuco been the favorite wood for bows?
Before it was used, ironwood and fruitwood was used, and we're talking about mid-1600s, 1700s. And once it began to be used in the late 1700s, it changed the sound of music. And it also coincided with the turnover from Baroque into classical music. And it's not an accident, because you can do a lot more with the stick. It's much more nervous in your hand, and you can accomplish a lot more with it.
Talk about the luthiers that are in your own shop.
I'm really being able to live the dream. I get to enrich people's lives by bringing music into their lives and promoting the artistry of living makers. And I'm surrounded by creative and interesting people all the time. So one person in my shop is a graduate of the School of American Violin Making in Utah. She just joined us half a year ago, and we have one of her violas and one of her cellos at our shop at the show that started this week, actually, and will go on for another 4 weeks of modern makers from across America. We have over 40 instruments and bows. We're going to have people coming in to visit this weekend on Saturday. And some area Philadelphia makers will be there.
This wealth of new instruments? Are they more desirable than the old ones? Everybody thinks how valuable really old instruments are.
In this country, people still think that an older instrument, even from mid-1900s or better yet, 1800s, is the preferable instrument. But I have to say there has been just an amazing leap of quality of making in the last 20 years. It's probably due to the fact that beginning about 15, 20 years ago, and I think the bow makers were in the forefront of this, we started sharing information with each other. And that improved the quality of our making immensely. And at that time, I have to tell you, everything was a trade secret. Nobody shared information. If it was your varnish, you kept it your varnish. You never told anyone about it. And so 20 years later, you have a wealth of knowledge that has created a golden period of making in terms of craftsmanship and sound.
Well, Elizabeth Vanderveer Schock, thank you very much for speaking with us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
Bowmaker Elizabeth Vanderveer Schock spoke with NewsWorks Tonight producer Kimberly Haas. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.